This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. April 8th, 1994, NPR's All Things Considered.
Kurt Cobain, the lead singer with the rock group Nirvana, was found dead today at his Seattle home. He apparently shot himself. Cobain had struggled with drug problems for several years, and last month had briefly lapsed into a coma in Rome after mixing drugs and alcohol. Nirvana helped pioneer the style of rock music called grunge, and was the first grunge band to reach a mainstream audience with its album Nevermind. From member station KUOW in Seattle, Marcy Silver.
I don't remember what we called it, but we didn't call it grunge. Nirvana was the first band to really hit it big outside the city. They opened the door for the success of Soundgarden and Mudhoney and Pearl Jam, so many others. Their music belonged to the world, but these bands, they were ours. Like so many Seattleites, I heard the news that a body had been found at Cobain's Madrona home earlier that drizzly day. Another radio station had broadcast a rumor. It was unconfirmed by Seattle police. I'd been covering the Seattle music scene for NPR. The editors there wanted a story. They knew this was important, but they weren't sure exactly why. I knew if anyone had something to say about Kurt Cobain's legacy, it would be Charles Cross. At the time, he was the editor of Seattle's weekly music periodical, The Rocket. Cross has been writing about Kurt Cobain ever since. 20 years later, he still remembers that day.
I was sitting at 2028 Fifth Avenue, my office of The Rocket, above the Palace Kitchen, in the corner office there, and we were trying to put an issue of The Rocket, this magazine I edited, out to press. Courtney Love was to be our cover subject. And, you know, I'm sort of having a nightmare day as an editor of a newspaper, and the nightmare got worse. The phone rang. It was a guy from a local Seattle radio station called KXRX. And he said, you know, we've got a report from an electrician has called us, and there's a body been discovered at Kurt Cobain's house. Do you think it's possible that it is Kurt? I just still remember to this day holding the phone away from my ear and not quite responding immediately and having the news soak in. And I just thought, it can't be him. It just simply can't.
I think, if I'm remembering correctly, it hit the wires. Remember the days of wires, mm-hmm. where things would bing if there was a bulletin. The wire binged and madness ensued in the city. I mean, that's what I remember. It was mad in your office, but it was like it instantaneously spread. Did somebody take to a radio station right away and start announcing it?
What actually happened was that the police finally confirmed about 11 or so that a body had been found. But the fact that it was Kurt was not confirmed until later in the day. Television stations rushed to the house, and literally they're filming as a body is carried out on a gurney with a sheet over it. That day, things just went nuts. When we found out Kurt was dead, I had the unbelievably grisly task of going to our art department and ordering that Courtney's picture be taken off the cover of The Rocket, and instead we put a picture of Kurt, her now deceased husband, on our cover. It just was unbelievably horrible. Now, of course, I'm just talking about my job as a newspaper editor, which was horrible. The true horror, of course, is those that knew Kurt very well and loved him and his family. I mean, as I began researching my 2001 book, Heavier Than Heaven, I find out from Kurt's sister that she found out that Kurt was dead from a report she heard on KXRX radio. At that point, the police had not contacted the whole family, and she called the radio station and said, "That can't be my brother that's dead. The police would have had to have told me." And of course, they hadn't reached her. They didn't tell her, and she found out her brother was dead from a radio station.
I mean, at that point in time, had you given any thought at all to what Kurt Cobain's musical or cultural significance really was?
Well, a little bit of thought because, you know, Kurt's death in some ways was the most horrible thing that ever happened, and it was shocking. But he, remember, had already overdosed a couple times that year. Rome, which had been a month before his death, was reported as a near-death overdose. In fact, not only was it was reported as his death. CNN went out on the air and said that Kurt Cobain had died. So everybody was somewhat prepared for the fact that Kurt was struggling, and you know, maybe he would die of an overdose. That was not the suicide aspect of it, indeed, was far more shocking. As I began to research my books and found out that he tried to kill himself at least six times, it ultimately is not shocking. But I'm not sure that at that point any of us could truly imagine that Nirvana, you could imagine Nirvana breaking up, because frankly, there had been some tears apart at the seams in the year previous. But you couldn't imagine Kurt not making music. That was the part of it that was inconceivable.
How were his songs, what he wrote for his band, different from Alice in Chains, Mudhoney, Pearl Jam, all those bands that had hit the big time at the same time?
There were some similarities, but what Kurt did and what his greatest gift was is that he was able to have his voice be in every song. And by voice, I'm not referring to his vocal quality. I'm meaning when you listen to a Kurt Cobain song, you think he is singing to you. The subject of most of his great songs are himself, his inner psyche. And he did that better than anybody. I think that was what really separated him from everyone else.
Talking with Charles Cross, who has just written another book about Kurt Cobain. Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. You mentioned that Heavier Than Heaven, your biography, came out in 2001. When did you actually start work on that?
I worked on that for about 4 years. So Kurt died in 1994. I honestly, that day, that crazy day that he died, I had four messages on my voicemail at work from book publishers. Write a book, get one out immediately. It didn't seem like at that point, one, I didn't think I could write about it emotionally, and it didn't seem right. But what shifted for me as time went by 1998, so much had been misreported about Kurt. So much was wrong. And I felt to some degree some kind of ownership of the story, that I at least wanted the Seattle music scene part of it told correctly. I mean, one example was I constantly read that Aberdeen was a suburb of Seattle. Aberdeen's 2.5 hours away from Seattle, but it could be on another planet for all it has to do with Seattle. Kurt lived in Seattle for less than a year and a half, yet he is forever associated as Kurt Cobain from Seattle. Seattle's Kurt Cobain. Kurt grew up in essentially a shack in Aberdeen for most of his life, lived part of his time in a trailer. And this was not a world full of possibility or artistic accomplishment or many of those other things. And yet he did the very unlikely thing and took that past and created great art out of it.
You mentioned you had three voicemails from various, I assume, publishing companies that wanted you to start going out and researching. How did the research that you did shape what eventually became the second book, which is all about cultural legacy?
In researching Heavier Than Heaven, I learned so much about drug addiction and about suicide that I did not know about. And I couldn't present those. I couldn't present my thesis, my argument, my, if you want to call it a liberal agenda, call it that. But my opinion on how misguided this country has been on these issues. And Kurt is the greatest example we can find about that.
I'm thinking specifically about the glamorization of heroin.
If there's one thing that Kurt Cobain is most misunderstood by general culture, it's that people think he himself glamorized drug addiction. You know, I've read thousands of interviews he did. I've read his every journal page he's ever written. He never said anything that glamorized drug use. In fact, his message was strongly anti-drug whenever he talked. He talked about his own problems very directly, very personally, and with great emotion. And in his journals, he writes again and again and again, God, please help me. Please let me kick this.
Did he ever seek out counseling?
He did. That's another one of the myths about Kurt. Not only was he in rehab five times, he saw a psychiatrist. He got some help. The problem is, of course, since we lost Kurt to suicide, clearly he didn't get enough help. It wasn't the right kind of help. It wasn't good enough help. And when Kurt went to the final rehab, which he went to willingly, he was not put in the lockdown ward. He was in a ward where you could leave, and then right next door was a ward where you were locked in a room. You know, if there were mistakes made, which there certainly were, one of them was that some of his counselors were not told that about all his other previous suicide attempts. What do you do? We've lost him now, but if there's anything that most doomed him, it was that. But even that said, it almost becomes a spiritual question. What if somebody did tell him and they locked him down? They had to let him out at some point. The choice to either live or die is ultimately up to an individual. And we can't commit somebody and lock them away forever because they've been suicidal or because they're a drug addict. Where I think the world has shifted is there's less shame in talking about this stuff now than there was. And maybe Kurt's death plays a small role. However, heroin addiction is at an all-time high, and so is suicide. We lost 31,000 people in America last year to suicide, and the number keeps going up and up. Kurt Cobain is not the only one who suffered from these problems, and sadly, 20 years after his death, this is a national epidemic that we need to deal with as a public health crisis and not a moral issue.
You mentioned that one of the things he had was this ability to seem as if he was singing to each person personally. Do you think that's what made him the cultural icon that he is now, 20 years after his death?
I do. I think ultimately the greatest gift that he had was that gift of songwriting. And he was able in those songs to craft lyrics and melodies, but I think even beyond melodies, it was his lyrics that made him who he was. He wrote lyrics that touched people, and they felt like they were writing them, or they felt like he was talking about part of their psyche, or even the anger of Smells Like Teen Spirit that's there. We all can relate to that to some degree. And pop music hadn't touched those topics before. Pop music was rarely about anger or angst or depression or frustration or addiction. And Kurt was able to put that in there. And I think that's the reason it touched so many people at the time. And I think it still touches progressive generations.
I would imagine that there are thousands of teenagers every year who are still downloading songs.
Well, I write in this new book that I think Kurt has sort of taken on a generational milestone. He's like J.D. Salinger. Everybody reads Catcher in the Rye. And at some point, every adolescent kid has to deal with Nirvana if they're a fan of music. Surely Nirvana's records don't sell what they did 20 years ago. But for a band that hasn't put out a record in 20 years, their sales are still pretty impressive. You may not be a fan. Not everybody is a fan. But you have to understand what that artistry was about to really understand the history of pop music.
We were talking a few minutes ago about the fact that only a year and a half of Kurt Cobain's entire life was spent in Seattle. But you write, you call him the ideal rock star for Seattle. Why?
Seattle has always been somewhat uncomfortable with its role in the spotlight. And so was Kurt. We want to be a big deal, but we want to be different. We want to be a little off. And we want to be unique. We don't want to be like we're following anyone else. And that was Kurt Cobain in a nutshell. In some ways, he was also an ideal rock star for Seattle because in Seattle, no one would bother Kurt. I saw Kurt walk down the street that we're on. Nobody, when he was famous, nobody would come up to him and say, "Hey, Kurt Cobain." That's not Seattle's approach. In LA, he would have been mobbed by paparazzi everywhere he went. He had the capacity to have an anonymity here that was really about his artistry and not about his celebrity.
Here's the city and here's this musician. And here we sit in Seattle 20 years later talking about it. And that tie between a man who isn't even from here originally and people who remember that day is still, I was going to ask you, why do we care? But we do still care.
We do care. He's ours and we're his, you know. He only lived here for 18 months, but he's ours. And Seattle feels a cultural identity that is tied up in that music. This might happen in other cities, but if you're at a sports event in Seattle and they're trying to rile the crowd up, they put on Smells Like Teen Spirit. It is our anthem. Forget Louie Louie. It Smells Like Teen Spirit. That's Seattle's song. That song was played for the first time in Seattle. That song was celebrated at a record release party in Seattle. That song was ours. In a song that everybody in radio thought would only be a hit at night. No one thought that was going to be a hit. Took off partially because of the people of Seattle. it's ours.